You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, I know you love podcasts. Believe it or not, there are a lot of people out there who still haven't been turned on to podcasts or don't really know what a podcast is. So help celebrate Podcast Month by sharing Kick-Ass News or any of your favorite podcasts with at least two friends. Or better yet, share us with all your friends on Twitter or Facebook and be sure to tag us when you do and use the hashtag Tripod. That's TRYPOD. Spread the word about this podcast or any podcast. And if you want to do something else to support Kick-Ass News, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/Kick-Ass News. Believe it or not, this show costs actual money, and your contribution will help offset some of those costs. So become a part of what I'm doing here by going to GoFundMe.com/Kick-Ass News and making a donation. Thanks for listening. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. What do Dick Cheney and Rahm Emanuel have in common? Aside from polarizing personalities, both served as chief of staff to the President of the United States, as did Donald Rumsfeld, Leon Panetta, and a relative handful of others. The chiefs of staff, often referred to as the gatekeepers, wield tremendous power in Washington and beyond. They decide who's allowed to see the president, negotiate with Congress to push the president's agenda, and most crucially, enjoy unparalleled access to the leader of the free world. Each chief can make or break an administration, and each president reveals himself by the chief he picks. Now, through extensive intimate interviews with all 7 living chiefs and 2 former presidents, award-winning journalist and producer Chris Whipple pulls back the curtain on this unique fraternity in his new book, The Gatekeepers: How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Chris Whipple is a critically acclaimed writer, documentary filmmaker, journalist, and speaker. He's won 2 Peabody Awards and 4 Emmys for his work as a producer at CBS News 60 Minutes and ABC News Prime Time, including his coverage of the 9/11 terror attacks. Chris Whipple is the chief executive officer at CC Whip Productions. He's the writer and executive producer of The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs, which aired on Showtime, and for which he filmed more than 100 hours of exclusive interviews with all 12 living CIA directors and their top operatives. He preceded The Spy Masters with a 2-part documentary for the Discovery Channel called The President's Gatekeepers: Untold Stories of the White House Chiefs of Staff. And now he goes even deeper into the history and role of the White House Chief of Staff in his new book, The Gatekeepers: How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. And today, Chris Whipple will share why people call the Chief of Staff the second most powerful job in Washington, what makes a good Chief of Staff, and why the burnout rate is so very high. He'll reveal which chief of staff is widely considered to be the gold standard by other chiefs, which presidents thought they could do without one and wound up learning their lesson the hard way, and the Watergate figure who set the precedent for all chiefs of staff to follow. Plus, why every president needs a son of a bitch, and why you never, never, never hang up on the First Lady. Coming up with Emmy and Peabody Award-winning journalist and filmmaker Chris Whipple in just a moment. Chris Whipple is an acclaimed documentary filmmaker, writer, journalist, and speaker. He's won multiple Peabody and Emmy Awards as a producer at CBS's 60 Minutes and ABC's Prime Time. Most recently, he was the executive producer and writer of Showtime's The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs. And now he has a new book titled The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Chris Whipple, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Several people in the book say that the White House Chief of Staff is actually the second most powerful man in America. Is he more powerful than, say, the Vice President or the Speaker of the House?
If you ask Dick Cheney, he'll tell you that the White House Chief of Staff has more power, if you want to put it in those terms, than the Vice President. What he doesn't tell you is that that was true except when he was Vice President. So it depends on the personalities involved, but yeah, I mean, Jim Baker says it's the second most powerful job. He also tells people when a chief becomes chief, the first phone call he makes is to Jim Baker for advice, and Baker always replies, "Congratulations, you get the worst blanking job in government." But it really is true that the White House chief is, I mean, it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of the job in governing the White House effectively.
Yeah, and I guess Vice President Cheney would know because I think he's the only person who's held both jobs, Vice President and Chief of Staff.
That's correct.
Well, I think a lot of people hear the term White House Chief of Staff and they think it's perhaps something akin to, I don't know, a human resources position. While that is an element of it, I guess, it's a lot more than that. So tell us, what are the duties of the White House Chief of Staff?
Well, first of all, there's nothing in the Constitution about it. He's unelected and unconfirmed. But the White House Chief is not only the gatekeeper to the Oval Office who creates time and space for the president. He's the guy who controls the information flow. He's the honest broker of information in that respect. He's the Jack Watson called him the javelin catcher because you're always taking fire, enemy fire and friendly fire. He's the heat shield. At the end of the day, he is the person the president depends on to execute his agenda. And there's no more important role. And if a White House does not have an empowered chief of staff, usually that way lies disaster.
And you titled the book The Gatekeepers, and I suppose that's a big part of the job. It seems to me that it might be perhaps the hardest part of the job as well to keep the president from being bombarded with questions and agendas from every direction and yet make sure that he gets what he's going to want to know.
No, that's exactly right. It's a really delicate balance, but it's critical. And, you know, Gerry Ford tried to govern with a model very much like Donald Trump's, where he had five or six senior advisors with equal access. They would come and go, and they would compete with one another. It was a disaster. You know, within a month, Ford realized that it was unworkable, and he reached out to, guess who, a young Donald Rumsfeld, who came in and really, you know, started, made the trains run on time. You know, that job is just critical, and it's creating time and space for the president to think, which is important. It's making sure that there are no end runs, as they call them. Now, an end run is when senator or a congressman or a CEO comes into the Oval Office, sits down with the president, pitches something that is completely inconsistent with everything the administration stands for. And the president says, "Yeah, Senator so-and-so, that sounds great. Let's do it." You know, the chief of staff has to be there to prevent end runs, and they can be more serious too. Just ask anybody in the Nixon administration what happened when Chuck Colson started coming and going from the Oval without a chief of staff around.
Does the White House chief have to be part clairvoyant to anticipate a president's needs, to divine what a president's going to want to know about and what his priorities are going to be on any given day?
You don't have to be clairvoyant, but it helps if you're grounded, if you're confident, if you've been around the block the way James Baker, everybody's pick is the gold standard, was, the way Leon Panetta was, who'd been in Congress and been OMB director and wasn't afraid to walk in and close the door behind him and tell Bill Clinton what he didn't want to hear. You have to be able to do that. And I'll give you an example of something that might sound almost clairvoyant, and that was when Ronald Reagan was determined, hell-bent on going to Capitol Hill. The first act of his administration, he wanted to tackle Social Security reform. He'd been talking for years about making it voluntary. And Baker listened to this, and he'd been around long enough to know that Social Security was the third rail of American politics, as he put it. You touch it, you get electrocuted. He explained this to Ronald Reagan, managed to, with Nancy's help, among others, to turn him around on that, change course, and persuade him to go for tax cuts, tax reform first, and the rest is history. It's hard to imagine Jim Baker allowing a president to go after repeal and replace Obamacare when it was obvious from the get-go that the votes weren't there, and even if they'd somehow passed it, it would have come back to bite them in the ass. So that's what a chief has to do.
Yeah. So that would have fallen under the purview of the White House chief of staff to have made sure that the president had the votes before he risked the embarrassment of not being able to pass, repeal, and replace, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. That's on Priebus. And, you know, when Baker was there, he created something called the Legislative Strategy Group, LSG, which became famous and became a kind of template. Dennis McDonough tried to create something similar under Obama. That was a staff of really smart people who knew how to count votes. You know, Richard Darman, Ken Duberstein was the congressional liaison. These guys really knew what they were doing. They knew the Hill. They knew how to count. Clearly, you know, nobody in the White House does, apparently, as we speak.
You mentioned that James Baker is the guy that every White House chief of staff points to as the gold standard for what a chief should be. What did Baker do right?
He did a lot of things right. You know, he wasn't flawless. But again, what he did was, I mean, it was a great story in the book that I'll tell you that involves Baker and his rival for influence with Ronald Reagan, Ed Meese. You may remember him. Mm-hmm. He was a senior counselor to the president. Meese had been Reagan's chief of staff in Sacramento when he was governor, and was the odds-on favorite to become chief of staff. Reagan, to his credit, and with a lot of outside advice, was smart enough to choose Jim Baker. But when he did, Reagan turned to Baker and said, "Do me a favor, make it right with Ed." Well, Baker called Meese and set up a breakfast for the next morning. He pulled out a yellow legal pad and said, "Why don't we just divvy up our responsibilities, lawyer to lawyer, Ed?" And so Baker proceeded to give Meese a whole lot of fancy titles, and Baker got everything that mattered. He was the gatekeeper. He was with controlling access to the Oval. He was the guy who controlled the flow of information, the paperwork. So that's the honest broker role. He was the guy who executed Reagan's policy. You can have all the fancy titles and talk about policy all day long, as Meese did, but Baker was the guy in charge of executing it. So that'll give you an example of what kind of a savvy operator Jim Baker was.
Right, and I was surprised to read that another person that many chiefs of staff say that they admire is actually H.R. Haldeman. In fact, you say, despite Watergate, Haldeman kept Nixon from getting himself in a lot more trouble. Tell us more about how he insulated the president.
Haldeman, the thing about the book is that, you know, this is not just a book, you know, with lessons for presidents and chiefs. It's a book that is full of, you know, really amazing characters. You know, Aaron Sorkin couldn't have dreamed these guys up, you know, beginning with people like Haldeman, Don Rumsfeld, Cheney, Rahm Emanuel, and then people that you may not even have heard of, like Jack Watson, who was Jimmy Carter's chief of staff during his final year and a brilliant guy who should have been chief on day one. But anyway, Haldeman is fascinating because the irony is that he became the poster boy for Watergate, the worst scandal of all time. And yet most of his successors credit him with having created the template for the modern White House chief, you know, the empowered chief that we've been talking about, who mm-hmm. performs all these roles and makes the White House function. He became, most of the chiefs would say, he wrote the book.
What were some of the protocols and precedents that he established for that job?
Well, again, the critical importance of the gatekeeper role and giving the president some time and space, making sure that there weren't end runs by people who would take advantage of the president, making sure that the information flow was good, and playing that role as an honest broker. And then, of course, famously in Haldeman's case, he was the pluperfect son of a bitch, as he called himself, and the Lord High Executioner. that's what Nixon once called him when he had called a cabinet meeting together and told his entire cabinet that they had better obey Haldeman or else. but anyway, so that was the template that Haldeman created. And what I think Jim Baker and Leon Panetta under Bill Clinton proved many, many years later was that you don't have to be a son of a bitch. You know, Panetta was obviously Baker was a very smooth operator and he was popular. Leon Panetta also was a guy who was described to me as he had an iron fist inside a velvet glove. you know, he's a gregarious guy with a booming laugh and everybody likes him, but he could lower the boom when he needed to for Bill Clinton.
Over and over, you see White House chiefs of staff say that every president needs a son of a bitch. So he was the exception to the rule, or?
No, you have to be a son of a bitch when necessary, but you don't have to be a son of a bitch every day of the week. Mm-hmm. And if you are, and arguably there are a few guys like that, it's not productive. John Sununu, who was George Bush 41's chief of staff, was pretty good managing up. Managing the president, terrible at managing the staff, demeaning, arrogant, did not suffer fools, and he paid the price when he was embroiled in a scandal of his own with using military transport for personal trips. He had few friends to defend him. So I think that it's a balance, and Baker mm-hmm. and Panetta were among the best at striking that balance.
How about Rahm Emanuel? He's a notorious political brawler. Did that serve him well as the president's son of a bitch?
I think, you know, in the beginning with Rahm, there's another great story from the book is when he was, prior to his incarnation as chief for Obama, he was Bill Clinton's, one of his senior advisors, and Rahm was just famous. You know, remember he once sent a dead fish wrapped in newspaper to a pollster who had, it was the Luca Brasi treatment. Rahm was a guy who famously took the hill. You know, whatever it required, he took the hill and he got results. And one, not once, not twice, but multiple times, Bill Clinton tried to fire him because he pissed off some friend of Bill Clinton's. And Bowles would ignore him. And finally, Clinton said, "Why haven't you fired Rahm?" And Bowles said, "Because, Mr. President, every time you come out of that office with Mission Impossible, we give it to Rahm. And he comes back 2 days later and it's done. There are 10 bodies on the pavement, but it's done." And so Clinton gave up trying to fire Rahm Emanuel. Anyway, the short answer to your question about Rahm as chief of staff is that I think Obama needed. Obama certainly felt he needed somebody who could get a lot of stuff done on Capitol Hill. And Rahm knew the Hill better than anybody. He was in line to become the first, may recall, he was in line to become the first Jewish Speaker of the House.
Right, I think, right.
I think that's a job he really wanted. When he was asked to become chief of staff to Obama, he basically asked himself, you know, what do I say when the president asks you to do it? Well, all you can do is serve. And I think he served pretty well in getting a lot of stuff done early on.
Mm-hmm. What kind of traits make for a good chief of staff?
The ability to strike that balance between being tough and being reasonable. You have to be politically savvy. You have to know how to reach across the aisle, if that's possible in this day and age. You have to know your president, but it's a mistake usually if you're too close to the president, if you're just a good pal, a friend, because then you can't tell him what he doesn't want to hear. And I think that, you know, an underrated quality that both Baker and Panetta had is temperament. You know, these are guys who were comfortable in their own skin. They'd been around the block. They didn't have anything to prove. Jim Baker was a 50-year-old, smooth as silk Texas lawyer. Leon Panetta had been in Congress. He'd been OMB director. These were guys with gravitas.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear that anybody in the White House measures up to the example those guys set.
Are plugging leaks within the purview of the chief of staff?
Well, plugging leaks, you know, leaks are as old as the presidency. You're never going to be able to plug leaks. And that's always going to be a fact of life. And I think, more importantly, you need to be able to talk the president off the ledge when he tells you, as Nixon told H.R. Bob Haldeman, that he wants to put everybody in the State Department on a polygraph test. He wanted to give lie detectors to something like 30,000 people in the State Department.
Wow.
or another order that Haldeman ignored was when he asked him to firebomb the Brookings Institution because he thought there was something in the safe, that he some documents that he had to have. Haldeman ignored that one too.
And I suppose he's also the one who makes the call when there's a crisis to wake up the president in the middle of the night. He's the one who makes the so-called 3 a.m. phone call, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Unless you were one of Bill Clinton's chiefs, in which case Clinton would call you.
That's right.
He was famously nocturnal.
Yeah.
And Leon Panetta tells this great story about being sound asleep. The phone rings and he looks over and he sees that it's Clinton, and he goes, "Oh my goodness, you know, it must be a big crisis." And he picks up the phone, and Clinton says, "Leon, are you watching Fritz Hollings on C-SPAN?" And Panetta says, "Mr. President, no one in the country is watching Fritz Hollings on C-SPAN, and you shouldn't be either. You should be asleep." And hung up the phone. Anyway, yes, that is part of the job.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll return with more with Chris Whipple when we come back in just a moment. Amazon's acclaimed crime series, Bosch, is back for a third season. Titus Welliver stars as Detective Harry Bosch, an honest cop driven by a dark past who's obsessed with punishing criminals no matter what the cost. Haunted by the discovery that his mother's murder was covered up by the police, Bosch also finds himself implicated in the death of a serial killer he's investigating. Now Bosch must navigate the dangerous waters of a police department that believes he's guilty while working with a partner who is no longer sure he can trust him. Bosch will fight to prove his innocence even as he pursues a dangerous group of ex-Special Forces assassins willing to kill anyone who gets in their way. Against the glamour and seediness of Los Angeles, Bosch will risk everything to clear his name while bringing down the murderous crime ring, no matter how many rules he has to break to do it. based on the best-selling novels by Michael Connelly, streams Season 3 on Amazon Prime April 21st. And now, back to the podcast. I guess the first president to really have to deal with the issue of the 3 a.m. phone call being a possibility was Eisenhower. I was interested to read that he was the first president to appoint someone designated as the chief of staff when he entered the White House. Having been the supreme Allied commander during World War II, I suppose Ike would have been pretty familiar with the idea of a chief of staff in the military. Is that where that comes from?
Yeah, that is where it came from. And there's a great story about Harry Truman and what Harry Truman said when upon the election of Eisenhower. Truman said, "Poor Ike, he's going to snap his fingers and he's going to say, do this, do that, and do the other thing, and nothing will happen. It's nothing like the military." Well, what Ike tried to do was he wound up creating the position by appointing Sherman Adams, a former New Hampshire governor, a gruff, tough, monosyllabic guy. He became known as the abominable no man. he was that tough as a gatekeeper.
And before Eisenhower, who fulfilled the duties of a chief of staff for the president, or was it maybe even a team of people?
It really began with Eisenhower, the sort of empowered chief, and then Haldeman took it to a whole new level. But prior to that, you remember Roosevelt's famous team of rivals, and
right,
and that. But you know, it really people presidents who have strayed from the Haldeman model have learned that it's critical to have an empowered chief of staff in order to govern. Now, you know, Kennedy tried with a bunch of advisors. It was sort of like Jerry Ford's spokes of the wheel. Then came the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy decided he really started to lean on his brother Bobby as a kind of de facto chief. Lyndon Johnson, same thing. He had a bunch of Lyndon Johnson was his own chief of staff, but that didn't end well either. Consumed by Vietnam. So in the modern history of the presidency, particularly from Nixon until now, that history is just strewn with the wreckage of presidencies that did not learn that lesson.
Right. I guess you have Ford, who went for a brief period without a chief of staff. And then there was Carter, who tried to be his own chief of staff, as he put it. And we saw how that turned out. How much of their decision to leave that position unfilled was a response to Watergate and in some ways a sort of rebuke of the kind of all-powerful chief of staff that Bob Haldeman was?
Yeah, that was very much on Jimmy Carter's mind. Carter was really, you know, Haldeman was the poster boy for Watergate. And Jimmy Carter felt that appointing a strong chief of staff, one guy as the first among equals, would send the wrong message that it would look like an imperial White House. But what he found out, And this is key. I mean, just think about Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter was arguably the most intelligent president of the 20th century, nuclear scientist. This was a guy who could absorb enormous amounts of information and synthesize them and distill them. But Ronald Reagan, by contrast, and was famously and I think unfairly called an amiable dunce. I remember Clark Clifford was the guy who tagged him with that. Mm-hmm. But Reagan understood something that Carter did not. And what he understood was, and something, by the way, that Donald Trump does not. And what Reagan understood was that an outsider president needs a consummate insider like Jim Baker to get things done.
You have the example of Clinton's chief of staff, who was a boyhood friend of his. Is it usually a bad idea to appoint someone who's a buddy or someone who is so much in your inner circle?
Yeah, I'll give you another quick anecdote on that. When Barack Obama was about to win the election, he did this quietly because he didn't want to look like he was overconfident. But he called a private meeting of his staff and Clinton's ex-White House chiefs to talk about who his White House chief should be. Huh. And Erskine Bowles, who was who is quite a character and is, you know, he's unfiltered. He tells you the unvarnished truth. Obama barely got the question out when Bowles snapped, "Leave your Chicago friends at home." And of course, the room was full of his Chicago friends.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Daley, Pete, you know, Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, and they all sort of turned pale. And as it turns out, he did not follow that piece of advice. But what Bowles was talking about was people like Jimmy Carter bringing their friends, Ham Jordan, who was completely miscast, who was sort of the de facto White House chief for Jimmy Carter in the beginning. Mm-hmm. People like, you know, Bill Clinton made a mistake bringing his childhood friend, Mac McClarty, in as White House chief, not because Mac wasn't a very talented, very smart, very popular guy, but friends, good friends of presidents, have a hard time telling them what they don't want to hear.
Yeah, and we talked about James Baker. He was followed up by Don Regan, and he made the fatal mistake of running afoul of First Lady Nancy Reagan. You know, I can kind of understand how a White House chief of staff might think, you know, well, dealing with the First Lady, that's the president's job, not mine. Is it important for a chief to have a pretty good relationship and communication with the First Lady, too?
Yeah, it's critical, mm-hmm. as Don Regan found out the hard way. You know, Regan had all kinds of problems. This was the most disastrous job swap in American political history. What happened was James Baker, who was burned out, swapped jobs with Don Regan, who was the Treasury Secretary. It was Regan's idea, and Nancy Reagan's usually infallible radar failed her. She didn't see this coming. She later described it as the biggest mistake of the Reagan presidency, putting wow. Regan in there. But Regan came in, and the next thing you know, they had the Iran-Contra scandal, mm-hmm. which, in my opinion, never would have happened on Jim Baker's watch. You know, this cockamamie scheme that was hatched in the White House basement to trade arms to Iran for hostages. And then the end for Regan was when he had an argument with Nancy Reagan and hung up on her. And as Jim Baker put it, that's not just a firing offense. That's a hanging offense. And he was gone a week later.
Yeah, and you mentioned James Baker's burnout. You know, the longevity of chiefs of staff is not very high. I think you say that on average, they last about 18 months with, I think, 5 years and 3 months being the record held by Andy Card. What are the usual circumstances of their exit? Is it their decision or the president's decision?
Well, it's almost always the president's decision. As Andy Card put it to me, if anybody tells you that they're ready to leave the White House, they're probably lying. It's not a place anybody really wants to leave. Mm-hmm. But almost all the chiefs, I mean, obviously they serve at the pleasure of the president. They can be fired in a heartbeat. Sometimes you have to drag them out. They had to practically drag John Sununu out. but having said that, very often, you know, they burn out because the nature of the job is just relentless, mm-hmm. unforgiving. You know, as Rahm Emanuel described it, you don't know which way is up. You wind shear, whiplash. You're being fired at, taking friendly fire as well as enemy fire.
Yeah.
He was vivid about it. And so there's burnout. And then very often, if things aren't going very well, you become the fall guy for the way things are going.
And when it's the president's decision, is it often a case of the chief of staff has screwed up or is starting to drop the ball? Or in some cases, is letting them go perhaps even an act of compassion on the part of the president?
Yeah, the answer is both. Mm-hmm. You know, it sometimes, I mean, most of the chiefs will tell you that you can't really function in that job at anything like you know, full tilt with all your cylinders functioning, firing. Mm-hmm. If you stay too long. It's just too brutal. So, you know, it's probably a good idea to replace a chief of staff before the first term is up. Yeah, no matter how well you're doing. Andy Card broke the record, as you suggested, about 5 years and 3 months. But Andy Card, I think, probably should have gone. Andy Card would be the first to tell you that he probably should have gone sooner.
Mm-hmm. And aside from Watergate, what are some of the worst examples, or best examples, I should say, of presidential scandals, missteps, embarrassments that could have been avoided if the chief of staff had been on his game?
Well, you know, that's the really stunning thing that I learned in doing the book and in talking to every living White House chief, two presidents. I talked to secretaries of state like Colin Powell, a lot of staffers. And it's really striking because I'm convinced that from Watergate to Iran-Contra to the Iraq War to the rollout of Obamacare to the botched executive order on immigration that we've just seen, that the White House chief makes the difference between success and disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis McDonough is amazingly candid, Obama's final chief of staff, amazingly candid in the book about how the Obama healthcare rollout was his mistake, and he takes complete responsibility for it, and he blew it. And he admits it. And he said it was the longest walk he'd ever taken, that short walk from his office to the Oval, to tell Barack Obama that the website was not working. Barack Obama, instead of chewing him out, did kind of a long, slow burn. And McDonough felt terrible. In fact, he said it would have been so much easier if he just yelled at me.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't sure he'd have a job by the time he got back to his office, but he did. They moved on.
I have to think that there are many outside of the White House who might be uncomfortable with the idea of so much power resting with an unelected official who doesn't even undergo any sort of confirmation hearing, really has no oversight or anyone to answer to other than the President of the United States. Has that ever been an issue of controversy?
I don't think it has, because I think there's just so little understanding outside of the White House of what the role of the White House chief really is. I think very few people realize the kind of power he has. Now, I happen to think that if you're worried about that, then boy, is this the White House for you?
Yeah.
you know, and if you oppose everything Donald Trump stands for, boy, is this the White House staff mm-hmm. for you? It is. You know, the level of incompetence is off the charts. So what I'm trying to say is that I think the alternative of a White House chief who is feckless and unempowered and at war with five or six other senior advisors for the soul of the president is a much bigger problem than an empowered White House chief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chief is not abusing any kind of power. And he can be fired in a heartbeat. A functioning White House is preferable to one that is just in chaos.
Since you brought it up, I can probably guess the answer to this question. But as we approach the 100-day mark, how would you rate President Trump's chief of staff, Reince Priebus?
Well, let me just say, in fairness to Priebus, that back in December, 10 former White House chiefs were invited into Dennis McDonough's office, and they met with Priebus to give him advice.
Mm-hmm.
And the common piece of advice they gave him was what we've been talking about, that he needed to make sure that he was empowered to run the White House. When the chiefs left the office, Priebus dutifully took notes and seemed earnest. When they left that meeting, none of them thought he had much of a chance of taming Donald Trump. So in fairness to Priebus, we're dealing with the president who shows no evidence that he wants a grown-up in the room. You know, governing is hard. It's got nothing to do with running a family real estate firm in Manhattan. Pitting your lieutenants against one another on the theory that this creates some kind of creative tension does not work in the White House. It's a recipe for failure. And so far, it's the most dysfunctional White House in recent history.
Well, yeah, and I'm constantly hearing in the media about the infighting between Steve Bannon and the Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump camp. But I don't hear very much about the influence of Reince Priebus on the president. Is the fact that Priebus is not making it into the media? Is that a sign that he's doing his job and serving the president well, or is it an indication of his lack of influence within the inner circle?
I don't think it's a sign of much of anything one way or the other. I think the signs that matter are the utter inability of this White House to get anything done that's substantive, their inability to govern. I mean, no competent White House chief of staff would allow an executive order on immigration to go out into the world without being vetted by the departments in charge of enforcing it. It's hard to imagine Jim Baker or Leon Panetta allowing a president to go down the road of repeal and replace Obamacare when they had no votes. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, you know, this, you choose your cliche, train wreck, the gang that couldn't shoot straight. That's an insult to the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up, we've never had a female chief of staff in the 50 or so years that we've had that position. Do you think we ever will? And why haven't we so far?
It'll happen. I think that, you know, think about it. How many female presidents have we had? How many female campaign managers have we had? Maybe one, maybe two. It'll happen, but it's not a surprise, I think, that it hasn't happened yet. It almost happened in the Obama White House. There was a contender, but she didn't have the political chops. Mm-hmm. She was good at policy. I don't think it's going to happen with this president by any means, but it'll happen someday.
Is it a position that's prone to high testosterone, macho-ness?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Not necessarily.
All right.
I think that, again, you don't have to be the president's son of a bitch, except when it's really necessary.
Well, once more, the book is called The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Chris Whipple, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Just a reminder, folks, that Amazon's Bosch is back for a third season. Titus Welliver stars as Detective Harry Bosch, an honest cop driven by a dark past who's obsessed with punishing criminals no matter what the cost. Based on the best-selling novels by Michael Connelly, stream Season 3 on Amazon Prime April 21st. Thanks again to Chris Whipple for joining me on the podcast. You can order The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency on Amazon, or download the audiobook for free with a special promotion just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. You can visit Chris Whipple's website at chriswhipple.com and follow him on Twitter at CCWhip. That's CCWHIP. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.